And a big welcome back to the Endurance Hour podcast. I'm Dave Erickson. This is episode 132. Roger is off this week because we have a special guest on the program this week, all the way from London, England, an Australian living abroad. I guess that's how you would put it. Our guest this week is Luke Taberski, and Luke is a gentleman who is living life to the fullest. He's an endurance athlete, to say the least, an adventurer, an ultra marathoner, a natural cook. He's a writer, fitness coach, and he is fueled by real food. We'll have all the links on endurancehour.com so you can connect with Luke on social media. What's really amazing about the interview you're about to hear and see if you're watching this on YouTube is the fact that this gentleman has had a varied career. He's a former professional soccer player and retired at the age of 28, so he's a very young man. He's 33 now, 32 years old now, to be correct. He's also a double brutal extreme triathlete. He did a triathlon in Wales, I think it was last year. Basically, it was two Ironmans back-to-back inside of 35 hours. Not just your regular Ironman triathlon, but after the swim, there was thousands of miles of climbing, thousands of miles of climbing on the run, and they did that twice. So he is an endurance athlete. Let's call him an endurance triathlete as well. And his story is remarkable because he has a quest to do something no one has ever done before. He's calling it the ultimate triathlon. It's a swim, bike, and run from the northern tip of Africa to Europe, Morocco to Monaco, a total distance of more than 2,000 kilometers, and he has set a time frame, prepare yourself, of 12 days. So there is, of course, the swim, which is across from Africa to Europe. That's in one day, followed up by a 75-mile bike ride same day, and then he has a number of 100-mile plus days of cycling before finishing off, and I got to make sure I get this clear, of how many marathons, 14 marathons to finish off his swimming and biking adventure. And this is coming up in October of 2015. I think you're really going to enjoy this. This guy is, he's not sitting back and letting life happen. He is taking life with both hands and making the most of it. Very inspirational, and I hope you enjoyed this interview. We'll have a little bit more at the end of it with ways to connect, way to follow him on social media, and of course on his website. That is coming up here right now. We did our interview at the end of March. We did it via Skype, so this is what you're seeing, and this is what you're hearing. Hello, Luke. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. I've been doing a little research on your website and all your social media, and it's what a wide variety of places you've gone.
Yeah, well, you know, living life, living the dream, as you say.
Yeah. One of the videos I was just watching was, you were kind of interviewing them, a couple of ultra runners in Nepal.
Yeah, yeah.
And that wasn't that long ago, just a couple of months ago.
No.
Well, the video was posted a couple months ago.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a bit lax. I feel, obviously, I did my little research as well, and I feel a little bit embarrassed talking about YouTube to you, but bit lax on doing that. But no, I went out there in 2013 to run the Mount Everest Ultra, and I just asked a race organizer, can I come out and hang out with some runners? And basically, it went from going out to hang out with them for a weekend to living up in the mountains for like 3 weeks.
What an experience that must have been like to be in that environment. What do you recall?
It was life-changing without being cliche. It was phenomenal. I had no idea what I was getting into. I had no idea where I was going or anything like that. And it was just so humbling to walk into this person's house after being traveling for about 6 hours and walking 3 hours pitch black up this mountain. And the guy behind me is going, yeah, just keep going. I've got my pack on. I'm thinking, I'm going to fall over and break my ankle here. And then walked into this house and couldn't really see because it was all dark and just got flooded by smoke and everything. And then finally it all settled down because I was starting the fire. hole in the floor with the fire there, just seeing people's eyes, like his mother and his father and his wife and his child. And then it was all sort of like smoothed out mud floor, walls, thatched roof. And I heard this huffing noise literally about 12 feet away. And I couldn't figure out what it was, but it was a buffalo. The buffalo sleep inside next to you. And so I'm eating out of my hands on the floor with his home cooked meal. And yeah, that's basically what I was doing for several weeks. And then every day would go out running and that'd take me on different trails. And then I filmed the whole time I was out there. I'm hoping at the end of the year, have a sort of an adventure film completed, edited down. And so we did some interviews and talked to them about not just running, but life, growing up, going to school and stuff like that. And for me, that was the adventure I got the most out of, because it was just phenomenal.
Wow. And what they have available to them in Nepal in terms of resources or supplies is got to be challenging, and to be able to perform at a high level.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like with the whole Nepal thing, what I've sort of helping out with some of the Nepalese elite runners, and there's now people, more Westerners are helping them out because I can see the talent. But I went out running with them, and I just, you know, I'd go out for, you know, 5-6 hours. I just had a normal fuel belt with a couple of little drink bottles and stuff, and I'd put some nuts and some little mini bananas, and they would take just like some little chickpeas, and we'd be going out for 5 hours. I'm like, what are you doing? He goes, oh, no, it's okay. Where's your water? No, and they wouldn't drink, and they'd just go to a stream if they saw it and drink. And we're talking, you know, some hardcore climbing, like 10 miles. I think the normal 10-mile route that they did, they'd climb nearly 2 miles over 10 miles. And we're at 1,000 meters to 2,000 meters of altitude. So what's that, 3,000 to 6,000 feet. And yeah, if they find a stream, they find a stream. It was just phenomenal.
How can someone do that? What do you do as an athlete to adapt yourself? Is it something that in their genes to be able to continue with that, with little water, little nutrition, when everyone we talk to nowadays is you got to have 300 calories per hour, you've got to hydrate so many ounces per hour to maintain at a certain level, and yet they're doing this on subpar nutrition and calories?
Well, we were brought up in terms to them, yeah, as we ate too much, we overate, like in terms to them. So they were brought up in that way. So they were brought up not having copious amounts of food. They would have 1 to 2 big meals a day. Mostly it was rice. It was their main staple. And then they'd go off running, and they just got used to it. It's like now the whole people who go, you know, high fat and low carb and stuff like that, and a lot of ultra athletes now, and I'm one of them. Mm-hmm. I train myself. Wait, can you just – sorry.
No problem.
Turn that light on. I've got – the alarm's going off, so I don't miss it. And everything. Okay, we're good.
Okay.
So, you know, I've trained myself to be quite fat adaptive, and I can go out and smash myself for about 6.5-7 hours without eating, and I'm quite comfortable doing that now. I know the consequences of doing it too often to my body for recovery, but if need be, I can do that and perform quite high. Now, these guys have been doing that their whole career, so in their whole lives, so their body's used to and be able to adapt to burn fat as fuel, and also to store as much water in their cells without using it too much and becoming too dehydrated, as we would.
So have you learned, have you taken something from them to apply to your own training habits now, or your training routines that they've been doing for years, now you can do it?
Yeah, it was, that's where it really started with the whole concept for me of eating less, but going longer. And I was like, you probably saw my endurance background is only about 3 years or so. So I was new. And when I did the Marathon des Sables, I had gels and I had energy bars and I had recovery drinks. And yeah, I do come from a sciencey background. So I got that. Mm-hmm. I thought that makes sense. I'm going to do that. And then I went out there and it was like, the sheet was opened up and I was like, well, hang on, there's a whole new world out here. Like, these guys are phenomenal runners. One guy, IT, who I still keep in contact with now, he won a few races in Hong Kong and finished second to Kilian Jornet and Ryan Sand, some of the big Solomon-sponsored runners. I'm thinking, well, hang on, there's something in this. So then I came back from Nepal and yeah, sort of tried to eat less, but push myself further. And I was into cycling. I just started cycling up then as well a lot more because I was cycled my big trip down to Newquay to learn to surf, 18 hours in a day. So I started experimenting on the bike and the runs where I wouldn't eat every hour. I wouldn't eat for 2 hours. I went out for a four-hour cycle, a hard cycle with hills and things. Well, I'm not going to take any food and I'm going to have a coffee for breakfast and that's it and let's see what happens. And you know what? Once my head got around it, I was fine. You know, so I was always like, they just sort of opened that curtain to go, if you want to go long, you don't have to have those, you know, 100 calories an hour, stuff like that. Going fast and long is a different story. Mm-hmm. But for these guys, their fast and my fast in regards to minutes per mile was different, but exertion was similar.
I think that's the key right there. I was thinking, can we apply this to our training techniques around here? And that is, really is the key, isn't it, is how hard you push yourself. Because I've heard this statistic somewhere that if you were to have a race across the country between a man and a horse, a man would win because we can store more in our bodies to sustain ourselves endurance-wise.
Yeah, totally. There's a book, Running with the Kenyans. I think it's Running with the Kenyans. I don't know if you've seen that. A British guy wrote it. He went out there. And I think it's that book, but don't quote me. But basically, there's a story of a tribe over in Africa, I think it was in Kenya, where they would chase down antelopes and things like that to eat. So they would have all their good runners mm-hmm. and just slowly chase it. And it would run off, and then they would chase it. And then the tribe would slowly every day come with the kids and the elderly, and they'd pitch a tent there, and they'd follow the tracks where the runners are. And then finally, after several days, they would catch these animals because they would be so exhausted because the humans are just non-stop and they're ticking over, and then they're exhausted and they catch them, make the kill, and then in a day or two, the rest of the tribe meet them and they have a big feast and then they go and find off again.
So tell me about your natural cooking habits. I saw that one short video about almond milk and you took a bowl of almonds, you talked about soaking them, and then there's much more to that video, but what is your interest in... passion with natural food, cooking, and eating?
It came from actually going to Nepal and seeing that, you know, they ate all real food. It's from what they harvest and what they have there. And I also, just before I went to Nepal, I ate the stereotypical, very healthy athlete diet, you know, the carbohydrate from a team sporting point of view. I've been an athlete my whole life, and you know, the brown rice and the brown pasta and lean meat and lots of veggies and, you know, a good amount of good fats but not too much and all that. And then 2 years ago, just over 2 years ago, my stomach just went nut, boom, for whatever reason. And I still don't know, and I will never know, because Louis looked at everything. I had taken a holistic approach a lot of the times just to make sure I tick all the boxes, but I was loving life. I was in a very good place. I had all these adventures lined up. I had a really good partner I was with and all this type of stuff. Everything was great, but my stomach just was really bloated. I was really lethargic after I ate. I looked like I was 6 months pregnant after, you know, a glass of just a green juice I made in the morning and stuff like that. So I really had to strip everything back and then slowly add things to my diet. And I went, well, I'm going to take out, not that I ate much processed stuff, but I'll take out everything processed. I scrapped things like fruit for a while just because of the sugar content and things like that. So scrapped all sugar, any sort of forms, and slowly built it back up. And then I thought, well, I'm not having bread. I like bread. And I thought, well, I'm going to start trying to make my own, but with, you know, ground chestnut flour and almond meal and all this type of stuff. And then I've always been a cook in the kitchen. I loved cooking growing up, and I'm quite a decent cook. And then I got into the whole baking stuff, and then I just went crazy. I loved it. So mm-hmm. then I started experimenting with all like different baking techniques, cookies and muffins and loaves and cakes and you know, different like nut milks and things like this. And all my friends are like, we love breakfast at your house. Oh, we love when you come around, because I'd take a cake, but it would be, you know, like, no, nothing artificial or real. And I'm like, this is amazing. Oh, hang on, is this a healthy cake? I'm like, well, it's healthier. You can't eat the whole cake. You can have a slice. It's going to be better for you. And then I just thought, well, I need to share this, you know. So I'm slowly I'm slowly trying to put more recipes and things out there now. And I do have, I've got loads of recipes. I do want to try and get a cookbook out there sometime, but that's probably going to have to wait till next year.
So what do you make of all this gluten-free trending that's going on now? People have tests. They do the tests on their bodies and they realize, oh, maybe I have a, you know, whether it's dairy, whether it's gluten, and people are changing their diets now. Have you learned much about gluten, and is it possibly a factor in your diet, or has it been?
It's because obviously gluten's an inflammation substance in your gut, and can really inflame your gut. So my gut was clearly inflamed because of all the symptoms that I had. Basically, I've seen loads of doctors, and they just put it down now to, because I've done all these different tests as well for celiac, and it's all been clear, and they just put it down. I've got IBS, which is basically, we don't know what's going on in your gut, so we call it that because we can, and then we put a lid on, it's done. The thing is with this whole gluten craze is, most of the gluten-free stuff that you can buy is still full of, excuse my language, but shit. So if you are intolerant to gluten because of what gluten is, and also over in the States, they have, I think, what they call it, a super gluten now to make things really doughy and really sticky, and that's even worse. So if you're going off that, and you're going to go into just some other artificial synthetic product that they've made to substitute that, to make it stringy and so it tastes the same, it's not going to be any better for you. You're just taking rubbish out and putting something else in, but you're taking Y out but putting X in, but you don't want either of those. So there are, I think, just because of the way the Western diet has came, and with the over-farming and things like this, and, bottom line, everyone wants to make money. They want to farm more on the same piece of land and use minimal amount with less wastage on all their crops and their fields and things like that. And it's just the way it's gone. But I think a lot of people are, because of that reason, have sensitive to gluten. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of them are, especially in America. I think you guys are leading, and not far, Australia as well. They're coming along in having good products, making it aware what to do. But it's the people that just go, oh, I'm just going to buy a gluten-free bread. They've still got loads of crap in it, rather than actually make your own bread or scrap bread. I'm going to have something else, real food type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Where are you based out?
London.
You're in London. But are you Australian?
I am Australian.
Okay. You're a fitness coach as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that encompass? Are you a personal coach? Is there a certain specialty that you follow, or you coach?
I'm a personal coach. So I have all the standard sort of, I want to lose weight, I want to put muscle on, I'm getting married in 3 months. Mm-hmm. I want to run a 10K obstacle course, that type of stuff, and all that stuff. I also train ultra runners. Other runners as well, and endurance athletes. I've got guys who climb mountains. I've got two guys that do that, so I train them, and some other runners and some other obstacle course racing guys as well. So so that's my whole fitness coaching side of things with that.
Going back a little bit with one of your videos, and I heard the stat and I had to write it down, and I've heard of these type of adventures, but 6 marathons in 7 days through the Sahara Desert.
Yeah, that was easy, man. Like, actual distance, that's fine. My video on YouTube explains my whole experience with that. It's about 25 minutes. And for me, I think it's got like nearly 20,000 views. And for me, that's great. For you, that's a piece of cake. But it was pretty hardcore. I went in there with an injury, and it flared up after like 13 miles on the first day, and I struggled through and got through, and I got a stomach virus on day 3, which made me dehydrate on day 4, and they made me have a drip, otherwise they're going to pull me out. So I had a drip in the middle of the Sahara Desert and all that, and it was a great mental challenge, but physically, and I say this a lot and people laugh at me, but physically, I walked across the finishing line, or hobbled across the finishing line, and just went, I'm not tired. I'm not tired. And you'll be able to understand this as an athlete, is I trained to finish in the top 50. I busted my butt to try and finish in the elite top 50 out of 900 athletes. I was there. I finished 20th on the 22nd or something in the first day. So I was running up there when I needed to, but with everything else that happened, I didn't. So the last basically 3 days, I wasn't running at the level I'd trained at. So it was like I was just going out for a nice little Sunday jog. So I wasn't fatiguing myself. My body was fatigued because I was out in the sun all day and I was only having 2,200 calories a day because I was making my pack light and this and that. But I actually wasn't physically tired. So when I was back in London 48 hours later after finishing the race, I could hardly walk because my feet were just all infected, toes. I had to have surgery on my toes and this and that, whatever. And my knee had ITB syndrome or inflammation, whatever you want to call it. And I got back from the airport and my girlfriend's like, oh, sit on the couch, relax. I'm like, no, I'm going to cook dinner. Let's go to the supermarket. Let's go to this grocery store and I'll get some food. She's like, well, no, you must be tired. I said, I'm not tired. I had I lined up 3 clients the next day in a couple of meetings. And they're like, didn't you just come back from the desert? I said, yeah, I'm physically not tired. Because I wasn't able to push myself as hard as my fitness level allowed me. So although it was pretty extreme, but it was a really good experience, but I wouldn't say it's the hardest thing I've done.
Well, because as an athlete, endurance or otherwise, you train for the event. And so when the event's over, it's like, well, yeah, I expected to do that because I trained for that. If you didn't train for it, then you're probably going to feel like crap.
You train to do a sub 10-hour Ironman and you do it in 14 hours, you're going to be tired, but you're not really going to be that tired, are you?
Right. So you fancy yourself as an adventurer living life, and this may be embarrassing, but that one of those first videos from 2000 or 2.5 years ago, I loved it, was the Discovery's Chief Adventure Officer video.
Yeah.
I did like that, Luke. That was fantastic. Whatever became of that?
Yeah, no, it was basically, when I retired from soccer and signed up to Marathon Saabs, the desert race on the same day, totally didn't want to deal with life. I just wanted to escape life. I'm going to be an adventurer. And I told everyone, they're like, what are you going to do now? You finished playing soccer. And I was like, I'm going to be an adventurer. And they're like, let us know when you grow up. But I had a 3-year plan in regards to the ultimate triathlon, which I'm sure we'll get on to. So then I was looking everything, any competitions, anywhere I could get exposure, anything I could do next, you know. And actually a friend of me who was watching Discovery Channel saw this commercial, this ad come up for a role of the Chief Adventure Officer. And to apply for the role, you had to write a 500-word essay on why you would be good for the role and then make a clip about it. So I sat down and I've got no video making or editing skill. I grew up playing soccer and all I cared about was soccer and how I made that better. So it was food, nutrition, training. That's all it was. And then all this stuff comes up. So I wrote this script and I got all this sort of, I'll put myself in that situation. And then basically spent the next, there was about 2 or 3 days of filming with my sister and brother-in-law who live over in the UK. And we went down to, they live a bit more foresty area, and we did all these shots and clips and stuff and went down to the beach and did all that. And then I chopped and changed and edited all together with a friend, and we went, that looks pretty cool. I made the short list of 5 people.
Uh-huh.
Didn't win. Never heard anything more about the winner or what the competition happened afterwards, but it was a lot of fun to make, and I really liked it. I thought it all worked well together, and it showed, for not just for the competition, but it actually showed me as me. You know, I'm not serious, but I can be, and a bit of fun, and it was I liked the clip as well. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Channeling your inner Steve Irwin?
Oh, yeah. There's been plenty of that talk.
Yeah. No, I like those videos, and I'm glad you said that, because it does show your vulnerability when you are yourself. You put yourself in the environment that you feel most comfortable, and people can connect with you and go, I like that guy. Whatever you're doing, I like the personality that's coming through, and that came through to me. So that was good. So let's go ahead and talk about this craziness that you have in mind here in October of this year. 12 days, 2,000 K. You're calling it the ultimate triathlon. This Morocco to Monaco, is this something that you created or has it existed before?
No, it's No one, from my knowledge, has ever done anything like this. The route's never been done. Basically, 3.5 years ago, as I said, I wanted to do something big. I wanted to be an adventurer, and to get myself noticed and to put me on the map, as I say, mm-hmm. everyone does that big thing. People stand up and go, wow, that was crazy. And I looked at a map, I still remember, and I just was looking for something. What? No idea. Wasn't a triathlon, wasn't anything. And then I just saw this body of water between Africa and Europe. Mm-hmm. And I went, I think you could swim that. And I went, yeah. And then I went, okay, what could I do next? And I went, well, maybe I could cycle. And then I saw the length of the southeast Spanish coast. And I went, that's quite long. I sort of know roughly how that is. That's quite a long one. And then all of a sudden, and then the rest just, it was like, well, then it's a little bit shorter from the Spanish and French coast to Monaco. And I sat back in my chair and went, swim, bike, run. Morocco to Monaco. I'm doing it. And didn't tell anyone for about 6 months and researched it myself. And then I've got a couple of friends who are Ironmen in Australia and started talking to them, and they just shook their heads and went, it's too much. You can't do it in 12 days. It's too much. If you've got to make it longer. And I went, no, I think I'll be okay. Mind you, I never owned a bike and I'd never swam. I knew how to swim, but never had swam in a squad or did laps or nothing like that. And I was training for the Marathon des Sables desert race, and that's it. And I was like, no, that's fine. So then the next sort of 18 months was about researching, talking to people that knew the area, that knew the distances, and see if we could work it out. And one of my very good friends, who's a 12-time Ironman, he's a massage therapist, he's worked on me, so he knows me as an athlete, as a person. He's pit crewed me for a couple of things. He grew up on the southeast coast of Spain, and I said, right, you make the route. I said, you tell me how far I can go in a day and which day goes longer or shorter because of some parts flat, some parts a bit lumpy and this and that. And I said, you tell me, can I do it in 4.5 days or do I need to do it in 5.5 days or, you know, all 5 days? And he went through and come back and he said, 4.5 days is doable. And then I basically looked at the kilometers for the run and measured that up, and the swim was always going to be in a day, and that's how it came up with 12 days, and it's just over 2,000 kilometers, but, you know, 2,000 kilometers in 12 days sounds better. And so, yeah, I looked at a world map looking for something big and unique and large, and that's what literally just came to me.
So there's got to be something that's you're bringing exposure to. Is it just for yourself that you want to put yourself on the map, or is there a benefit to this to somebody else or to an organization?
No, I'm not affiliated with any sort of organization right now, and it is first and foremost to benefit my brand.
Yeah.
But my brand, people say, why do you do this stuff? And it's simple, to inspire others to get out of their own comfort zone and live life. And I actually got an email last night from someone who I have no idea, never met before, and he's doing the Marathon des Sables, and it starts next week. And he has a similar knee problem to me, and he came across my website, and he watched it, and he looked at it and read my blog, and he was basically, he had no idea how he was going to do the race. No idea how he was going to finish, and he saw me, and he said, it was really inspiring, it was motivating to see you go through what you did. He said, now, whenever I'm struggling, I'm going to think of you, I just want to say thank you for all that motivation. And that email, that response from a guy who I've never met before, and I probably never will meet, that's why I do it. Because I hope there's loads of other people out there that come across and see what I do and go, well, if he can do that, why can't I go and walk to the shops or walk to work instead of catching the bus? If he can do that, why can't I? I've always wanted to do that art class on a Saturday afternoon, but I've been rubbish at art. But screw it, I'm going to go and do it. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it's for my brand, but my brand is about inspiring others to try new things, get out of their comfort zone, and bottom line, live life, because that's what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Now, I kind of understand as an athlete, the swim, you know, that would be a one-day event. Cycling, people can have a couple of centuries. They do 100-mile rides they can do. But the whole 14 marathons all within this period, even 6 marathons in 7 days is remarkable. But you're throwing 14 marathons within 12 days after doing the swimming, after doing the cycling. I'm really confused on how you can possibly do this physically and, you know, let alone cross the finish line standing up, but, you know, just to your support system, the organization that has to go into this, not self-support. There has to be a SAG crew. There's got to be somebody with you.
Yes. Now there will be a crew. I'm being tested and monitored throughout this year by a big university in London. Mm-hmm. They got on board to basically make sure I'm going to be fit enough. I'm doing all my own training programs and all my own training apart from the swim. I'm working with the British record holder for swimming the Gibraltar Strait two ways in one day. I just Googled the British record holder and he came up and I called him and said, we're working together. You don't have a choice because I'm doing this and I want to work with the best. So, so I'm working with the guys at Roehampton University to just do some tests, the physiological and psychological tests throughout the end of the year. And they'll be there with me to monitor me. I will have, my crew is not finalized, but I will have some sort of doctor or medical person on board. You know, my physio, who's known me for a very long time now, he'll be there. Plus, you know, I've got friends who said, yeah, we'll come down for a couple of days and cheer you on and this and that. But I'll probably have a core group of anywhere between four and six people, and then I'll have other people randomly coming down with me. So it's basically like a stage race. So mm-hmm. The first day I will swim, and then I will cycle about 75 miles after the swim on the first day. And then I've got four full days of cycling, which ranges from around 200 miles to 220 miles or 215 miles a day for 4 days. Mm. And then I've got 7 days of basically 50 miles to finish off.
Luke, you could have added a few more days to this.
I could have, but I don't think I need to.
It might help. I mean, you're talking about a couple of days of riding 200 miles. I know you're doing it. I'm not trying to talk you out of it at all. I just
go for your life. I want someone to give me a legitimate reason and make me think why I shouldn't do it, or make me think of something I've not thought of. Mm-hmm. I challenge everyone. I'd love someone to say you haven't thought of this and go, well, I haven't. Thanks for pointing that out. Now,
yeah, yeah.
But I know what you're saying, and I know what you're saying, and I know what I'm capable of. No, actually, I retract that. I don't know what I'm capable of mentally, but I know what I've done. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to the mental challenge. I've very rarely in everything I've done actually had to tap into that proper, deep down mental reserve that all endurance athletes have. They've just got to find a way to do it. I've gotten to the front door of it, but never actually had to open it. So I want to open it. You know, I really want to have to work that hard to go, I need to call on everything here. Physically, I know what it's like to cycle, I'm just saying, one day for 18 hours twice. I've done over 18 hours twice before, and I know what it's like to do that just in a day. And so mentally I can understand that distance for a day, but doing it for 4 days after a swim and a cycle, obviously it's going to be different. 50 miles a day for a week, I know it sounds really ridiculous. After doing all that, I'm not concerned about that, because all I'll do is I'll put my head down and I'll just shuffle along. The biggest thing, people say, what's your biggest concern? Mm-hmm. There's two things. The first is that the tides don't let me get in the water early enough on the first day, because I have to cycle the 70, 75 miles on that first day. So if the tides don't let me get in first thing and I get across in, depending on what the currents are like, anywhere between 6 and 9 hours, and then get on the bike and do my sort of 4.5 hours there, I get to bed too late. Mm. And I don't get enough sleep to start the next day, because I'm going to start at probably 6:30 every day throughout the rest of the days. Now, if I don't get in the water quick enough, early enough, I'll struggle on the first night and not get much sleep. Now, the second thing I'm concerned about, and the main thing I'm concerned about, which can really hurt me, is those first 2 to 3 nights which are going to be very, very long days, and the longest days of the whole trip, not getting enough sleep to recover with the sleep deprivation. So I may only get 3 or 4 hours sleep. How am I going to go after getting 3 or 4 hours sleep for 3 nights when I'm doing 16, 17-hour days?
Yeah.
That's my biggest concern. It's not the fact that I've got to run 7 days or 50 miles at the end of all that. Mm-hmm. That will just happen. Yeah. I'll just shuffle along and I'll get it done. But it's the sleep deprivation, how I'm going to go for the last day or the second last day of the cycle.
You make an Ironman seem easy. It only takes one day to do an Ironman.
I wouldn't know. I've never done a single Ironman.
You know, this is over a 12-day period, and all the training that goes into an Ironman throughout a year, people plan their whole year to prepare and to finish an Ironman. You're preparing from now until October. I know you've already prepped before this. There's a lot of time management and financing that goes involved. How are you organizing your life right now to be efficient and to take care of this? I mean, if you don't have any like major sponsors at this point or a main backer, what are you doing? Just this, maybe it's my personal question. How are you financing all of this and managing your life?
I'm very good at time management. Very good. I get every ounce out of the day that I need to. I'm very busy, as we all are these days. But I'm always doing something, and then I'm always thinking one step ahead to be able to do all this. To answer your question directly, how do I finance all this at the moment is from coaching other people. So that part of the business, I do a little bit of writing here, there, and everywhere. So I get a little bit of income from writing a few articles here and there. I teach people how to cook as well, do some confidence in the kitchen, cooking lessons and things like that. I've only just stopped, but I used to bake for a couple of cafes in my local area, some of my real food baked goods, but it wasn't worth my time. Mm-hmm. So I had to give that up, although I loved it. I have a few small, very, very, very small sponsors and backers, but nothing big. But so right now, my drive is to promote the Ultimate Triathlon, to promote this, and to try and get some funding, because it is going to cost a bit throughout this year to train and to just prepare and to get this off the ground how I want it to.
I think it's a great idea reaching out to podcasts like ours to get the word out of and bring exposure to you. And you're going to be active on social media, or at least have a team to do so while you're actually doing the event. And then I saw that you plan on doing some live streaming somehow during the event. How does that going to work? And how can people follow you? Where do they go?
It's never really been done before this. So there's obviously going to be problems, but it's exciting. I'm working with a company at the moment called Streaming Tank, which they're basically the leaders in the UK of streaming events. So they do events like for a big shopping mall, they'll have an opening or something. So they'll do a countdown on their Twitter feed with videos, but they'll also stream the live events. Or if there's a red carpet affair, like the latest James Bond film, they did their big launch. Well, this company filmed that and streamed that and had it online instead of having it on the television type of thing or pay-per-view. So they were with big brands, these guys, and I just got in touch with them, and they were quite intrigued, and obviously they got me in, wanted to see me what it was all about. But basically, we're still working things out, but basically we're going to have a satellite, and there's going to be the main editor, who's we're going to have cameras, which we're not sure was in the process of talking to different camera companies that have Wi-Fi capabilities, like a GoPro or a Garmin, something like that, so you can control it from your iPhone or iPad and things like this. So we get all this footage and we get it loaded onto the central hub in a car, in a van that we're going to have. And we're going to have satellite connection. So they're going to basically either throw the raw footage on my website on a stream, mm-hmm. and just see me there at times of the day live doing this, or they'll quickly chop and cut it and put that there. So it might be 5 minutes delayed, or it could be just raw footage streaming live. Now, I wouldn't want to watch me cycling on a road for like 10 hours. You know, I wouldn't even want to watch me doing that. So it's going to be live at times. So,
okay.
Start of each day, it's going to be live when I'm getting ready, I'm eating and, you know, having a chat to people, because there will be a forum, things like that. People ask me questions, and then when I set off each day, that'll be great. But then we're trying to work into the script now. Then we can cut back and show what happened yesterday, or show the route, like they're doing the Tour de France. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to go up here and this and that, and then maybe cut back to me live for a couple of minutes, and then some interviews that I'm doing throughout this year and my training throughout the year. So it wants to be able to tell the story of where I came from. So you've been watching it all the time. Then you met some guy and you need to watch this guy. He's on day five, but
yeah.
You know, you can catch up. So they can go and they can go to day one and see the swim, and they can go and see this and see the highlights for each day and get up the speed within, you know, half a day. But then there'll be countdown timers of when it's going to go live, and there'll be always videos that you can watch from previous days and things like that. So it's going to be a really interactive platform, and then obviously the whole entire time there'll be social media going. I'll be asked questions and responding in live time on the run and on the bike, and even we're going to try and potentially look at having a mic on the swim as well. So while I'm having a quick feed stop, because you can get waterproof mics, and there's another challenge over here that someone did for charity, a swim challenge, and they were mic'd up. So when they were feeding, they turned the mic on through Bluetooth externally and could have a chat while they're in the water and got good audio because they had a mic on them. So,
well, after this, the Discovery Channel may be calling you.
The phone's always there. And I didn't take the call. So there's still lots of things to work out, but we've got the general idea. We know it's possible. I've toned a lot of things down of what I thought could be possible. And I went, actually, no, that's not. So now we're working with, yes, this is possible. We just have to find a way to be able to do it. And with all these little add-on things like the mic for swimming and stuff like that, they're all great, but we just have to explore those in a little bit further in the future until we figure out exactly how it's going to be done.
And the best website for people to follow is what?
www.theultimatetriathlon.co.
Okay. I'll be sure to include that on our website and in the notes of the podcast.
Great.
Well, Luke, best of luck to you. Obviously, we'll keep track of this online, social media-wise.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for reaching out, and thanks for sharing your story.
No problem, Dave. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to keeping in touch with you throughout the year and see what you're going to get up to as well.
All right. Thanks, Luke.
Once again, thank you to Luke Taberski for taking the time out of his evening in London to speak with us here on the Endurance Hour podcast. I really encourage you to check out his YouTube channel. The video, Luke Taberski, the Adventurer, Chief Adventure Officer, a video he did a couple of years ago where he's trying to apply for this position with the Discovery Channel. And if you have a chance to, as he mentioned before, his 20,000 video viewed video called The Marathon de Sabs. I'm not saying that right. It's not a race, it's a war, but I'll link it on endurancehour.com, showcasing his time of doing those marathons. It's just remarkable, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at that. Luke also is on Twitter. It's his name, LukeTyburski, and on Instagram, and of course on YouTube. But his website, just one more time, theultimatetriathlon.co, to see his route, his hopes and dreams of getting there. He does have a sponsor on there. So if you're interested in getting involved with this first of its kind and probably only of its kind ultra triathlon, be sure to hit him up and contact him. That's going to wrap it up for this special episode of the Endurance Hour podcast, episode 132. If you missed last week's podcast or last podcast of 131, Roger and I were at Timex Camp in Tucson, Arizona. And in that, we talked about the camp, we talked about our Rookie of the Year award presentation and our speech to the 2014 Ironman Wisconsin winner, Daniel Brescher. We had special guest Bruce Gennari come on at the end and talk about his experience at the race and throwing down some bravado against Lisa Roberts, a professional triathlete, as they were coming down Mount Lemmon in Tucson. It's a pretty entertaining podcast, and we also have a video version of that on the YouTube channel, which happens to be freeze frame behind me on the TV monitor. I forgot to push play. That should have been going on. And coming up here in the next couple of weeks on the podcast, we have more guest interviews. We've got an interview with Elise Gallegos. She is a USAT coach. She's a three-time Ironman finisher. She's new on the Timex team. She's a rookie on the Timex team, and she's preparing for Ironman Texas here coming up. So that interview is coming up here probably sometime in April, most likely. We also have a great interview with James Burke. He was on the Timex Factory team. We got these interviews at Timex Camp, so it's not really, I'm not trying to push Timex so much. It's just we have some of these great interviews. Well, he was an amateur athlete, amateur triathlete. Only his second ever Ironman was in Kona, and he finished, I think it was 42nd overall or 40th overall. Now he's on the Timex Multisport team. We had a great, about a 20-minute chat with him in Tucson. A regular guy doing extraordinary things, letting you know that anything is possible. And he's a father, he's a husband, and he's doing it all. So that interview is coming up as well in the next couple of weeks. All right, I'm Dave Erickson. Thanks for listening. Roger and I will be back together pretty soon to do a podcast, but this is one of those kind of had a great chance to interview Luke, and so we wanted to get this out there as soon as possible. Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for following us on social media, on Facebook, and we'll talk at you next time. Bye-bye.